Thank you, Dan. We're going to be looking at Acts 19, verse 20 to 41. I'll read from verse 21. Now, after these things, Paul resolved in the Spirit to pass through Macedonia and Achaia and go to Jerusalem, saying, "After I've been there, I must also see Rome." Having sent into Macedonia two of his helpers, Timothy and Erastus, he himself stayed in Asia for a while. About that time, there arose no little disturbance concerning the way. As I was looking at this passage during the week, I found it a really difficult passage to prepare a sermon on. And I couldn't work out why. It isn't as if nothing's going on here, is it? I mean, we've got a full-scale riot. We've got the mob going on the rampage. There are all sorts of fascinating insights into Ephesian life and culture. But I just couldn't get anywhere with it. And then it dawned on me why. I think the second half of Acts chapter 19 is probably unique in the book of Acts, maybe in the whole of the New Testament. And it's this: it contains not one single word spoken by a Christian. The two major speeches in the second half of Acts 19 are both given by non-Christians. God has had his say in the first half of the chapter, and the results are visible for everyone to see. And now the world wants its response. And Luke, I think, allows Ephesus to have the pulpit for a little while. And the first of the discourses by this silversmith called Demetrius is a supposition of sheer nonsense, which is wrapped up in powerful rhetoric. And then the second, by the town clerk, is simply a pragmatic attempt to appease the crowd and to keep the peace. But God's work has already been done. He's had his say in the first half of the chapter. And you can maybe see why the Ephesian world wants to make its response at this point, because after 2 years of gospel preaching and teaching and witnessing and Christian living, it's made such an impact on Ephesus and Asia Minor that the cult of Artemis is at crisis point and her future looks uncertain. I'm not reading that into the text. I am reading it out of the text in Demetrius's own words. Verse 26, "You see and hear that not only in Ephesus, but in almost all of Asia, this Paul has persuaded and turned away a great many people, saying that gods made with hands are not gods. And there is danger that not only this trade of ours may come into disrepute, but also that the temple of the great goddess Artemis may be counted as nothing, and that she may even be deposed from her magnificence, she whom all Asia and the world worship." They're scared, aren't they? And I think Satan is scared. Usually in our studies in Acts, as we've followed the apostle round the Roman Empire, the riots break out at the beginning of his ministry, don't they? And quite often they serve the notice that it's time to move on from that particular town or city. But he's been working in Ephesus for more than 2 years at this point. And it's Paul himself who's decided that it's time to move on. He wants to cross back over the Aegean Sea, get back into Macedonia, visit Corinth again, Achaia, and then get back to Jerusalem and possibly then move on to Rome. And it's as if Satan has been left utterly powerless in the face of this sustained gospel preaching over 2 years. And magic, which Ephesus was famous for. And demonic darkness has been pounded and pushed back by the relentless word, verse 20, which continues to increase and prevail mightily. And Satan, in Ephesus, for the first time, has had to completely change his tactics. The damage has already been done to his kingdom. The church is mighty in Ephesus, but he wants to harass the church as the apostle is leaving. Maybe he wants to prevent him leaving, because he's heard that Paul wants to get to Rome, and he's terrified that what's happened in Ephesus is going to happen in the great imperial city itself. But let's get to the text and try to make our way into it. And my first point is going to be the way. My second point is going to be the truth. I'll leave you to guess what the third point might be. So firstly, we've got the way. About that time, there arose no little disturbance concerning the way. Now, the way is a name that the early church used to describe the gospel of Jesus Christ. We came across it first in Acts chapter 9, verse 2, when Paul was a very, very different person. He was Mr. Angry from Tarsus. But Saul, still breathing out threats and murders against the disciples of the Lord, went to the high priest and asked him for letters to the synagogues in Damascus, so that if he found any belonging to the way, men or women, he might bring them bound to Jerusalem. That was probably 20 years earlier. And if there was one thing that a Damascus-bound Saul was never, ever going to become, it was a member of the way, a person who belonged to the way. And yet Paul had found out that the gospel was mightier than he was, and that the grace of the Lord Jesus Christ had completely disarmed him, turned his life around, and the love of Jesus now constrains him. And something that can utterly transform your life and give you meaning and purpose in life, something that can give you hope in the midst of trials, joy in the midst of sufferings, something that can give you life where before there was death, and freedom instead of helpless captivity. That isn't a way. That is the way. The only way. And we imagine that the New Testament Christians had taken this from Jesus' words in John 14, where he says, "I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." What Paul had come to know for himself, people in their tens of thousands in Asia Minor and in Ephesus had also come to know. And by this stage, after 2 years, they are walking in the way. They're going somewhere in life. People all around the city, all around the region, they're not lost in darkness anymore. They're not sitting down in despair under the shadow of death. They belong to the way. And what I love about verse 23 is it's not just one preacher who has caused such a stir in Ephesus. It's the way itself. Paul might have been the focal point for the accusations. Yes, he preached and he taught ceaselessly about the way. Salvation through Jesus, the Son of God. But now there's a mighty church in vast numbers of Christians whose lives have been so transformed by the gospel that they no longer want nor need the sins and the magic and the superstitions and the idolatries of their old life. They don't need the crutches that they leant on before. They don't need the things that they were addicted to. They found something better or someone better. They found that God had sent his Son down into the darkness of our world. The King of creation had come as the servant to find us and forgive us, and to wash us from our sins, clothe us in his righteousness, to make us part of his great family, and then bring us safe to his home. And it's their lives, the life of the way, which is causing such a stir in Ephesus. People all over the city must have been so puzzled by these new Christians. They've known them all their lives. And yet in these last 2 years, they've become different people. They would have said to them, we knew you before. We didn't trust you. Now we know you and we can trust you. What's happened in your life? There's something so attractive about your life. There's this love and this joy and peace and patience and goodness and gentleness, faithfulness, kindness, this self-control. I'll prove this to you at the end of the sermon. We can find this in Ephesus. And others would have wanted to know about this. The way is gathering momentum. And they would have wanted to have told others. And that was my point last week, that it was the word in Ephesus which was doing all the work. This church hadn't been founded on gimmicks and novelties. We sometimes think that our society is so different to the world in which Paul was working. It wasn't. The Greco-Roman world was a world that was addicted to drama and to poetry and to games and philosophy and spectacles and great circuses. And yet it was the preaching of the word, and it was a group of people who were hungry for the word and who became saturated with the word that caused the gospel to carve its way through Ephesus. And I find that encouraging, because we haven't got drama and we haven't got poetry and philosophy and games and circuses, but we've got the word. And we've got people who are hungry for the word and want to be saturated for the word. And that excites me so much. So the word of the Lord continued to increase and prevail mightily. Secondly, we've got the truth, verses 23 to 27. And it really isn't too difficult to get to the truth in Demetrius's life. That's what I want to get to here. He's a silversmith who makes silver shrines of Artemis's temple. It's a lovely way that all the things that Luke writes about here we find in archaeology, we find in Roman literature as well. But archaeologists in Ephesus have found stone copies of Diana's temple, Artemis's temple, or even jade copies of the temple. But Demetrius, he's offering high-end, expensive copies. He's not like the Dell boys of Ephesus, who knock off the cheap stuff to the riffraff when they come in on the booze cruises or the stag parties. Oh, no, no, Demetrius, he caters for the more discerning fool. And as we listen to Demetrius, his God quickly becomes laid bare before us. If you look at his speech, he spends far more time talking about his prophets, which have taken a tremendous downturn since Paul started preaching in Ephesus, than he does about Diana. In fact, his loyalty to Diana, to Artemis, is secondary to his love of his income. Look at verse 27. There is a danger, not only that this trade of ours might come into disrepute, that's the first thing, the most important thing, our trade coming into disrepute, but also that the temple of the great goddess Diana may be counted as nothing, and that she may even be deposed from her magnificence, she whom all the world and Asia worship. And he makes this very powerful speech, which is wrapped around a completely hopeless argument. First of all, he waves the union card. Comrades, he says. And then he can wave the patriotic flag and the cultural flag and the religious flag. He even goes ad hominem after Paul. This Paul, he spits out. In some translations, this fellow Paul. Well, he's talking about a man who in any list of the most influential lives of all time ever always appears in the top 10. Imagine people saying, this fellow Einstein, what does he know? Well, that's what Demetrius is saying here. This fellow Paul. What, the Paul whose teaching has transformed your city and has set people free from your ridiculous superstitions? What, this Paul who in 2 years has undone 100 years of paganism and idolatry? And I would have thought that any right-thinking hearer of Demetrius might have been asking, if Diana really is so magnificent and so great, why hasn't she done anything about Paul? Why do you have to stand up and defend Diana, Artemis? Why is it that what Paul and his friends say is powerful and life-changing, and what the cult of Diana believes is dead and impotent? But Demetrius slips in his complaint, gets into the middle of the rhetoric so you don't notice it too much. And it's the greatest truth that he has to face, verse 26b, that gods made with hands are not gods. Oh, no kidding, Demetrius? Are you really wanting to challenge that thesis? I can remember hearing of a preacher who used to write in the side of his notes when he got to an argument that he wasn't too sure about. Argument weak, shout loud. Well, I don't do shouting, so whenever I get to that stage, argument weak, go fast. But this is the weakest argument you could ever possibly have. And yet he's wrapped it up in his powerful rhetoric that something you make can be your God. That something that has less intelligence than you, albeit temporarily, because those who make them eventually become like them, that could be a God that you can trust in and depend upon. The Bible spends many happy chapters ridiculing idolatry. And they are some of the humorous chapters in the Bible. You think of Elijah at Mount Carmel with the prophets of Baal in 1 Kings. Or you think of Isaiah's withering discourse on the fallen tree. You take a third of it and you make a lovely seat out of it. And a third of it and you warm yourself on a good fire. And then the other third, you carve a god and you bow down and you worship it. But make sure you got the right third. Don't go sitting on your god and burning the wrong thing. What happens ultimately, though, is not a laughing matter. Because when we turn to anything other than the one living God who's made our hands, we become more and more diminished as image bearers of God. That's Paul's point in the end of Romans chapter 1. We must go through Romans, I think, sooner rather than later. But Romans 1 verse 18 following says, look, as soon as you dismiss all the evidence of a creator, which God has left all over the universe for you, a designer, a maker, a sustainer. And you begin to swap the one true living God for the worship of things made with hands, or the worship of creation, or the worship of creatures, or the worship of yourself. God eventually gives you over to a debased mind. You become almost subhuman. You go your own way and everything begins to fall apart. And it's a devastating critique, not just of the first century world, but I think of the 21st century world. And we're such idolaters still. We might not be such transparent idolaters as Demetrius, although actually I think he worshipped many of the things that we worship. We've got behind the Diana cult. We've seen he worshipped his career. He worshipped his reputation. This trade of ours might fall into disrepute. We might be thought of as less. He worshipped his wealth, his possessions, his popularity. And they're all things that fail us when the greatest crisis of life comes. And it's so sad, because what Paul has been preaching in Ephesus, I imagine, was what he had been preaching in Athens as well. He has one sermon like most preachers. And it's the sermon of a creator God, a caring creator. You remember back in Athens, who's made everything, who has given us life, who richly gives us all things to enjoy, a God who wants us to find him, a God who has made it possible for us to find him, a God who will carry us and forgive us at great cost to himself, a God who will adopt us into his family through Jesus Christ, his son. You don't need dead gods when the living God is reaching out to you. So we've had the way, this great Christian movement. We've got the truth. We got to the bottom of Demetrius' life. What's our third point going to be then? The strife, of course. You've got a riot going on here, haven't you? Third point, the strife, verse 28. When they heard this, they were enraged and were crying out, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." So the city was filled with confusion, and they rushed together into the theater, dragging with them Gaius and Aristarchus, Macedonians who were Paul's companions in travel. I find that there is something absolutely terrifying about the mob, don't you? I think it's one of the worst things on earth. There is no arguing with the mob. There is no reasoning with the mob. It doesn't want to listen. It's just angry. It's one of Satan's greatest tools. Humanly speaking, it was the mob that sealed the fate of Jesus of Nazareth. People shouted louder and louder at the instigation of the priests, "Away with him, crucify him." And even a Roman governor who was supposed to have all the power in Jerusalem couldn't stand against the might of the mob. I don't suppose the mob has ever gone away, but it seems to have been given a new lease of life recently, hasn't it? We've had protest after protest over the last couple of years that have turned into wanton violence. We have a different sort of mob now on social media. The pile-ons on Twitter. If someone says the wrong thing, if they defend gender in the way that God has defined it in Genesis 1 and the way that society has defined it for thousands of years, then they don't deserve to have a voice. And the mob piles on. And they're shut down and they're cancelled. They must be transphobic, racist, Nazis who probably kill Bambi in their spare time. They're the most evil of people, apparently. Yeah, I fear the mob. We've got the mob in Ephesus raging. A man tries to stand up to have a say. He's called Alexander. He's a Jew. I don't think he's a Christian. He's trying to speak probably to disassociate the Jews from the Christians. But the crowd just shout louder, and for 2 hours it goes on. Look at verse 32. Luke points out that some cried one thing, some another, for the assembly was in confusion, and most of them didn't know why they came together. You can picture it, can't you? They're shouting, "What do we want? We don't know. When do we want it? Now." Look at the difference between the message of Paul and the message of Demetrius. We've seen it all the way through Acts. Paul's gospel is something that can be reasoned, and it can be persuasive, and it can be proved from the scriptures, and it can be explained, and it brings new life, changed lives. Demetrius's message brings confusion and anger and riots. Well, what was the answer to all of this? Who can still the fury of the mob? Well, Jesus can. What is so lovely is that in a chapter in which we've read earlier on of unusual miracles, that Jesus also works through quiet providences. As I said, in the latter half of chapter 19, not one Christian has to say anything. Paul doesn't say a word. He wanted to, but he was held back. He'd done his speaking for 2 years, And now Jesus, through quiet providences, resolves this situation. Actually, I think the quiet providences of Jesus were founded on the greatest miracle of all, the grace that had been shining from Paul and the other Christians' lives. And you notice that, first of all, the Asiarchs, who were friends of his, dissuaded him from going into the mob. Who were the Asiarchs? I love Acts. It makes you go to Google and to the commentaries to try and find out who these people were, and you find them all over history. The Asiarchs were basically the International Olympic Committee, combined with FIFA, combined with the people who organised the Chelsea Flower Show. No, they are. They are extremely high-ranking Roman officials who were the committee that was in charge of all of the festivals and all of the games and all of the feasts of the gods and the goddesses around the empire. And so you would have Asiarchs based where there was a temple to a great god or a goddess. So the Asiarchs of Ephesus would have been the steering committee for all of Diana's great events. And incredibly, these people who have every reason to hate Paul, because they would have been organising Diana's Royal Horticultural Show and Diana's Open, the invitation to all people around the empire to come chariot racing. And these were big events in the city that gave Ephesus prestige and fame. And they have every reason to hate Paul, and yet they're called his friends. So clearly they've met Paul. They've seen the love that he has for them. They've listened to Paul. They've seen his gentleness and his kindness. And though they're not Christians yet, and I hope they became Christians, they'd already become Paul's friends. And they could say, he's no danger to Roman society. This man is the greatest asset that Ephesus has ever received. And the town clerk, he gets it too. Sure, he says some stuff that the people want to hear about the great stone that fell from heaven, and nobody can doubt the fact that Artemis is the greatest goddess of all and her temple is here. But he gets to some truth as well. He can point out, you can say nothing against these Christians. They are neither sacrilegious nor blasphemers of our goddess. And that to me is so helpful. Take this away. Paul clearly has not spent 2 years preaching against something. He hasn't spent 2 years doing a bit of iconoclasm, going out at night writing "Down with Diana" on the side of her temple. Paul hasn't organized a petition to shut down Artemis's temple. What he has done, though, is spent 2 years preaching someone. And that's made the difference. He's preached Jesus. He's given Ephesus something better, the best. And even right-minded pagans can see that these Christians are not troublemakers. They are the best citizens that the world could possibly have. Our Jesus is not a boring Jesus. He's the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. Yet he doesn't act in a one-dimensional way. You love all the different ways he's worked in Acts. Sometimes he says it's time to send an angel, and I'll rescue my people that way. And sometimes he works a great miracle. But he also, and Dan prayed about this in his prayer, he has a still, small voice. And he whispers through quiet providences, even in Ephesian law courts and in the minds of pagan leaders. And it's in the quiet, mundane things that we so often trace the fingerprints of Jesus. Praise to the Lord, who when darkness and sin are abounding, who, when the godless do triumph, all virtue confounding, sheddeth his light, chases the horrors of night, saints with his mercy surrounding. Paul didn't have to face the mob. Jesus, through wonderful providences, as King of Kings and Lord of Lords, quietened the situation. Paul's job was to preach Jesus in Ephesus, not to shut things down. The gospel eventually does that. It changes societies. But it was to preach Jesus. Remember this, church. Our mission is not to change laws. Not by itself. Sure, there might be a place for petition and for peaceful protest, but our mission is so much bigger than that. It's to change lives. And we do that hand in hand with the King of Kings, who simply asks us to be his witnesses. And he gives us the message to say, and the Holy Spirit to help us do this, while he builds his church, and not Demetrius's mob, nor Nero's persecutions, nor Rome's inquisitions, nor communism's labor camps, nor Islam's fury, nor atheism's mockery is going to stop the King of Kings for a moment from going on building his church through the life and the witness of his people, taking the gospel to their communities. And the way continues to blaze its path through history. And the truth shines out in the gospel that we preach. And life comes to all who put their trust in this glorious, invincible Lord Jesus Christ. I've really enjoyed Acts so far. I've enjoyed the fact that it's telling us the same thing week after week after week. The word does the work. And I go, I've got to remember that. Preach the word. Don't keep silent. Keep telling your community the word. It's the word which is powerful. And finally, by about chapter 20, it begins to sink in. But I love what Jesus does next. And I love what he's still doing in the church and through the church today. So let's go on with excitement, because our King is King of Kings.